when you walk into the ring for the number one heavyweight of the world. You'll be ready, won't you? Why? Because I waited for 50 years to make you ready. You'll be able to spit nails, kid. Like the guy says, you're gonna eat lightning and you're gonna crap thunder. You're gonna become a very dangerous person.
Our show's name pays tribute to the Boer Trekkers of South Africa, who in 1838 soundly defeated 30,000 Zulus on the bank of the Nkomo River, thereafter called Blood River, from the water turning red with the blood of the slain. Miraculously, no Boer Trekker died and only three were wounded. Now your friend, Eddie Miller, will be your ambassador for tonight's show.
God bless you, dear Blood River Radio family. Thank you so much for hanging out, and thank you so much for all your contributions, your donations, your financial sacrifice for keeping us on the air. I really mean that from the bottom of my heart. You know, before we go to Sister Monica's hanging out for another seg, at least, we've been talking about we tar and feather people on this show. I'd like to give credit. You know, when we first started this program back in 2018, Matt Goodwin, who used to be, he was one of the original full-time co-hosts, he's the one that came up with that idea and said, we ought to start tarring feathering people every show. And that's what we do. So I'd like to, he did that. I tried to contact him today. I couldn't get in touch with him. I talked to Rich. Rich is going to try to get in touch with him for us. Good old Rich, the bearded wonder, who are one of our other brothers. We wrote to, our friendship was forged at the Battle of Charlottesville, just as like the same friendship. I'm getting goosebumps talking about it. We have my brother, Gene the Bitter Ender, me and the Bitter Ender and the Bearded Wonder and Matt and Simon Roach, we all rode to Charlottesville together, and I'll never forget that. I know Gene won't, I know Rich won't, and Matt, and neither will Simon. But anyway, Matt Goodwin got the credit for that, getting that tar and feather thing going. And I'd like to say something else. Talking about my rant, I may have come from the bottom of my heart. People, what you got to know, I'm just going to say this one thing before we leave the first hour. The so-called government we have, and I know I'm preaching to the preacher. 90% of you people know this. It's a criminal cabal. They are a Christ-hating criminal cabal. They hate Christ. They hate you people, you white people. They despise you. They hate your children. They hate your wife. They hate your parents. They hate your grandparents. They hate anything white, anything Christian, anything good. And they're out to kill you. It's even in their writing. They say it. We have professors at Harvard University saying that the white race needs to be wiped out. So the point I'm saying is, if you so-called push the envelope on the air, trying to get suggestions out there, solutions that actually work, and they come after us, then by God, so be it. Just like to repeat what Patrick Henry said, if it be treason, then by God, make the most. Let's make the most of it. Now I'm going to shut up. We're going right back to Sister Monica. She's staying over, and she's got some good stuff she wants to pass on to us, folks. So come on, Sister Monica. Come on up there to the batter's plate.
Okay. Well, you know, in previous weeks, we have been talking about some political prisoners. So I just want to give a little update on at least a couple of them anyway. Vincent Renoir, who I am in letter writing contact with, as is Nancy, and Nancy has previously read one of his letters on air, and he was so appreciative of that. So then he drew a nice little drawing for Nancy and myself. Of course, Nancy and I don't live in the same place, so I took a picture of it, sent it to her. But you know, just a field and sky just a nice scene of a hill in the background and some sunshine and whatnot. But anyway, I'm not going to read the whole letter, but I do want to read a part of it at the end. He's very cheerful in this letter, and I know he is feeling pretty good because he feels he has really done his job. Like, he has produced a lot of videos and essays and really exposed the lies of what the Jews have told us about World War II history, the Holocaust in particular. And all, I think he started out by investigating a particular story in a village in France. Maybe Nancy, you could jump in if you remember the particulars, and that's what got him started when he learned that the story they were being told in the mainstream about, you know, the evil, evil German soldiers was completely false and inverted. But anyway, Nancy, do you know that before I go on with reading a little bit?
No, I really don't. I think the most recent thing was Orbador. I think that's the only thing.
Okay. So, but anyway, he's talking in his letter about how basically he behaves well in jail, as did I. It's a good way to get through and you know, if you're friendly to them and respectful, then you tend to get treated that way. So, yeah, he's very nice. He draws for other people, too. Now prisoners are asked. I'll read here. Prisoners ask me for portraits or landscapes. I even draw for guards who are very nice with me. But everybody is very nice with me for two reasons. One, they can't understand I am in prison for writing books or making videos about Holocaust. In their mind, I am an innocent man unfairly jailed, which of course is true. I added that. Number two, I am very kind with everybody, always smiling and giving apples and cereals and pens to help people. If one day someone tells them revisionists are bad people full of hate, a loud burst of laughter will be heard in Edinburgh. Oh boy, oh boy. So this is in Scotland where he is imprisoned. Of course, they are trying to extradite him to France, in which case the prison conditions will not be so good. In where he is now, the conditions are very good. He's able to get lots of exercise, be out in the yard, and there he, I think, was it to you, Nancy, he said is basically like a, oh, here it says, he says it to me. It's a little bit earlier in the letter, because he talks about five prisons that he's been in. He's been in Belgium in a prison there, and three different prisons in France, and now in Edinburgh. And I'm never sure how to pronounce that, Edinburgh or Edinburgh, is the best one. Like a holiday camp, he says. I do exercises twice a day, so I take two showers a day, or even three when I go to the sport field of the prison, which is three times a week. I can read, meditate, write, and draw. Since 2 weeks, I have water paints, so I can paint. It's very nice. So he's doing fine there, and I think he's treating it like a sabbatical. Like, okay, he's worked really, really, really hard. Then he was on the run for a while, and he took an assumed name in the little village in Scotland and taught math. He was tutoring math. That's what he did. And then somebody routed him out and caught him, and now he's in this holiday camp, as he says. I mean, obviously, we got to take these things very seriously, because it's not always like that. And I know that the conditions, while I'm on that note, I know that the conditions in American prisons are absolutely horrible. And let's just take Matt Hale as an example. Sure. I mean, the most arbitrary, draconian thing, like that he's not even allowed to get mail now from anybody except immediate family and his lawyer. So I had a letter writing correspondence with him for a couple of years, and now it's been cut off for the last, I don't know, half year or so. And it's just draconian. It's just horrible. And he's been in prison already for, I think, close to 20 years, and he has another 20 years to go. This is unbelievable for a crime he did not commit, that they framed him with. But before we run out of time, another update is about a prisoner of war, and I call them prisoners of war because we are in a war, like we've discussed, and these are political prisoners, meaning they are prisoners of war. Marianne Wilfert, she was in a German prison for the last 15 months, and she was released this week, just a few days ago, March 21st. I guess that would be the equinox. She was released, and she has not missed a beat. I spoke with her on the phone, and I'm telling you, she was just going on the subject, the, you know, the forbidden subject. And then I had to stop her. I said, Marianne, just stop for a second. How are you doing? And then it was only at that point that I asked her how she was doing that she even, you know, bothered to tell me how she herself personally was doing. I'm telling you, when she was first arrested, she was being tortured because they injured her when they arrested her. She probably resisted, and her shoulder got dislocated. Her arm was dislocated, and they didn't do anything about it. So for 2 weeks, she was in absolute agony, and she thought she was going to die because she didn't know what was going on. She thought she broke her shoulder. She thought she was going to go into sepsis and infection and die. But then, they were just absolutely cruel to her. Like, there's a lot more I could say, but I know the first quarter is just about out, and I am going to bid farewell for this week. And thanks, Eddie, for having me on. But I guess until the music comes in, I could just say that she was in isolation also because she resisted taking the vax, and just like my brother didn't wear the mask and he was in isolation. So she was also in isolation for most of the time that she was in jail, and was treated very, very poorly. Like, she was not treated well, not like Vincent Renoir in the Scottish prison, where they can't understand why he's in jail and that he's unfairly prisoned. In Germany, in re-educated Germany, if you are, you know, the quote-unquote neo-Nazi, it's not good. It's not good. Mm-hmm. Although I have to say, over time, both Alfred and I, we had the experience that the guards, they went from, you know, first we were the neo-Nazis, so you get the extra special treatment, to being very well respected. So, yeah, I mean, obviously these are real people that we're dealing with, the guards, and I'm sure that some of them have good heads on their shoulders, and they start to figure things out, they start to see things, and they start to understand, and then they see that we are not the devil, and we don't have horns in our heads, and we're actually pretty nice people, if, you know, if we're treating them with just with politeness, and then they reciprocate. So that's kind of how it goes. But I'm gonna send out a prayer for Matt Hale, and I guess the break is on, and see you all next week. Bye-bye.
Well, I'll have a special request for you either next Saturday or the Saturday after that. It involves playing your fiddle. Well, thank you so much, Sister Monica. We'll be seeing you soon.
During our war for Southern independence, the brilliant Confederate general Robert E. Lee foretold the decline of this country when he prophesied, "If those people," referring to the dictatorial federal government, "if those people win this war, the United States will become a bully abroad and a tyrant at home." As Lee predicted, it has come to pass. The principles laid out in our founding documents, our Declaration of Independence, and the individual rights protected in our Constitution have been vilified and discarded. But not everyone has surrendered. Blood River Radio brings you highly respected, intelligent guests not afraid to speak the truth when the truth in America today is censored and attacked. Your contributions keep us on the air in order to fight against the bullies abroad and the tyrants at home. Send your war contributions to Blood River Radio, P.O. Box 34636, Bartlett, Tennessee 38184. That address is on our website, www.bloodriverradio.com. Don't let the bullies and the tyrants win.
As you are aware, America is divided over every fault line possible. This is intentionally fostered by those who do not love God, family, or country. We believe a peaceful future as a free people absolutely depends on civility. Clarion Call for Civility is looking for funding and volunteers at every level to make our hopes and efforts a reality. Please donate, sign our pledge, and help us in our sacred cause. Please visit callforcivility.com for more details. callforcivility.com.
Fighting for the soul of liberty and true pursuit of happiness for everyone. Freedom Fest 2023 is coming to the home of the blues and birthplace of rock and roll, Memphis, Tennessee, July 12th through 15th. It's the ultimate summit for liberty, educating and empowering through art, music, film, and comedy, while promoting economic freedom and highlighting today's political issues. Use promo code ROUND50 to save $50 off the current rate. Reserve your spot at freedomfest.com. See you in Memphis.
My day.
Dear Blood River Radio, precious family, I can't repeat this enough. If you will, we talked about political prisoners. Please keep in your heart, pray for our dear young prisoners that are in prisons. They're rotting in jail in Virginia for the Battle of Charlottesville. And you know what? They're totally innocent. They did nothing except, you listen, people, they were fighting for me, for you, for your children. They pay the ultimate price. They didn't know they were going to get arrested like that. And you know what? That prison would, it'll fall down from old age until they will have to do every day of their denim sentence. There will be no early parole, no nothing, because they're white people. And they dared have the damn nerve to stand up for Christian white people in this country. So please pray for the political prisoners from Charlottesville. Also, that's like one little comment. We're supposed to have John Friend on tonight. He couldn't come on tonight. He will be on next week. John Friend with the Barnes Review will be on next week. And we'll have somebody else on with him. I don't know who right now. Maybe Gene might want to take that assignment. I don't know. But whoever wants to take it, that's what we'll do. So anyway, we're going right back to Sister Nancy. So go ahead, Sister Nancy.
Okay. We're going to have to do our weekly tar and feathering. And so I've got a list of four Republicans this time that need to be receiving a whole batch of really hot boiling tar and a bushel of feathers. These four Republican fools are warmongers. The use of cluster bombs or bomblets has been banned by many nations, but not the big kahuna America. So we're going to send these bomblets and cluster bombs to who else but Ukraine. Of course, they can just step on them. The kids can get their legs blown off, their arms blown off. And the four Republicans who are supporting this, oddly enough, I think most of them are conservatives. Senator James Reich of Idaho, Roger Wicker of Mississippi, Republicans Michael McCaul of Texas, and Mike Rogers of Alabama. What is in the mind of these so-called conservatives who want to go to war? Why aren't they standing up for peace? Why do they want to continue to push for a war with Russia? Is there no end to this? Now, the next end is going to be when Russia finally wakes up to all of the red lines that we are crossing and decides to really retaliate against this country. I hope, if it does happen, that their animosity is aimed at Washington, D.C. There's another, there's two more people who really deserve a lot of hot tar and feathering. This black Julia Malema. He's a black in South Africa who openly calls for the murder of white South Africans. And how about this little black basketball female player in Memphis who sucker punched her white opponent right on the back as they were handshaking and ending up the game? She sucker punched that white opponent. So let's give her some tar and feathering too.
Yes. I'll tell you why. Before we bring Gina, I'm going to answer your questions. You want to know why these so-called good Republicans are doing that, the good conservatives? Because of the Jew. They've got to suck up to the Jew money. If they don't obey their Jew masters and go there and try to get the maximum amount of white brothers killed, Ukrainians and Russians are brothers. They're double first cousins. A lot of the Ukrainians are Russians. I know y'all know that. That's why they're doing it. Sister Nancy, because these Jews want as many white people killed there as possible, just like they have in every single war. And that's what
Absolutely.
They're doing. And one last comment. I talked about this in the first hour. You talking about the most incredible, arrogant hypocrisy. The United States is sending tanks in. Britain is sending tanks into the Ukraine with deactivated uranium that's known to cause endless diseases, pollutes water, causes cancer, and our veterans coming home from Iraq. They're sending F-16 fighter bombers over there. And they just got off their high horse and they told China, we can't prove it, but we think you're sending some deadly weapons into Russia.
Oh,
by
no,
God,
money.
If we find that's out, if that's true, you're going to be hell to pay. That's the arrogant, most insane hypocrisy I've ever heard in my life. I'm shutting
up. We're going to be in a war with China and Russia. That'll make sense, won't it?
Absolutely. Yeah. Well, before we go to brother, before we go to the Bitter Ender, we have a caller on. Caller, come on in there, caller from Ferguson, Missouri. Come on in there, Jim from Fergus Gum.
Eddie, I got your card with the no quarter motif, and I'm real sorry I haven't been able to send you a whole lot of quarters. It's just not possible now, and I apologize for that, but it's coming. You've hit on so many things, like the tar and feathering. It reminds me so much of Olaf Childress, rest in peace, used to put out something called a scallywag report. And that reminds me, he was years ago. He was so far ahead of the curve of me and so many other people.
He was my editor. He was my editor. I wrote
yes,
for
Monica
Olaf.
Knows all about him. Go ahead,
Jim. I wrote for Olaf Childress, yeah.
Excuse me, go ahead, yeah.
Yeah, well, he used to send me little samples of his publication when I owned JewWatch.com briefly. And anyway, you've hit on so many things, but I want to go back to this thing that you said, Eddie, about the digital currency, okay? There's a monument near Elberton, Georgia, called the Georgia Guidestones. It has 10 elements on there. The first one is the one that you need to worry about, and you've touched on this, the brother war. It's the TOS for continuing to use their means of wealth transference, basically. If you continue to use their means of wealth transference, and you know all about what they can do with that,
yes,
you agree to those terms, and the first one is the important one. The vast majority of actual Homo sapiens, that's people with between 1 to 4% of Neanderthal genome in their makeup, are to be exterminated. Every time you use your credit card or your debit card, write a check, or even when I write you one of those paltry little I forget what they call them. It's not a check. Money orders. That's all digital. It's all handled digitally, and it won't surprise me if they quit processing those money orders pretty soon, too. But that's the terms of service. By continued use, you agree that more likely than not, you're going to be exterminated like a roach. And that's the most important thing that I can say as far as standing up on our hind feet and resisting. I think Sheriff Max got the only thing going on that could do anything, and I'm afraid he started too late, too little, and there's too little interest. But you know, when the Federal Bureau of Immolation, who loves to burn their crime scenes so much, that's why I call them that, they do it all the time. When they declare something, the first time that he had a big event where he tried to recruit a lot of different county sheriffs, they declared him public enemy number one to our, quote, democracy.
Well, sure. Well, hell yes.
Democracy. And anybody that wants to do anything, I suggest if they've got an elected county sheriff, I don't. But if they do, get with them, and before you spend money on ammunition and freeze-dried food and all that stuff, you need to either support your county sheriff if he's inclined in this direction, or you need to support a candidate who you know will be inclined in this direction, because it's the only thing. You know, our current premier, Bidenov, has numerous times threatened us and said, what do you need with your little guns? You don't have nukes and you don't have F-15s. He's threatening us.
Yes, he did.
With nuking. And I'm sorry to tell him, but if I've got a pellet gun, I can get a contemporary main battle rifle if I'm careful about how I go about it. And if I have a contemporary main battle rifle, and if I'm somebody that has prior military service that's a jet jock, he can possibly take away one of those F-15s while the pilot and the co-pilot are doing their check.
Well, Jim, we've run out of time for this segment. I want to thank you so much, so very much for calling in. We've got to go back to our brother, the Bitter Ender, as soon as we come back from this quick commercial break. Thank you, Jim. Call in again anytime you want to, brother.
Your daily Liberty Newswire. You're listening to Liberty News Radio.
USA News, I'm Dave Collins. Mississippi's Governor Tate Reeves is declaring a state of emergency after a deadly tornado outbreak. At least 23 people are dead and dozens injured. Preliminary reports say at least a dozen tornadoes touched down. The state's House Speaker Mike Gunn says he's seen a lot of destruction in one little town.
Yeah, I am actually at ground zero here in Rolling Fork, Mississippi as we speak. Words just cannot describe the devastation that I'm seeing.
The Mississippi Emergency Management Agency says dozens of people were also injured by the tornado. At least four people are reported missing. The storm left a trail of destruction stretching over 100 miles. Rural towns like Silver City and Rolling Fork, about 60 miles northeast of Jackson, Mississippi, took most of the damage. President Biden says he and the First Lady are praying for the victims, saying the images of destruction coming across are heartbreaking. The R.M. Palmer Chocolate Factory in West Reading, Pennsylvania is no more. Video of a blast shows the building exploding like a bomb went off. Mayor Samantha Kagg added that a victim found alive in the rubble was one of six previously reported missing. However, she noted that the official death toll currently stands at two people. At least seven people have been taken to the hospital. President Biden has laid out a response to Iran after a suspected Iranian drone hit a U.S. installation in Syria, killing a U.S. contractor, injuring six other Americans.
U.S. military forces carried out a series of airstrikes in Syria, targeting those responsible for attacking our personnel.
The president said the U.S. will continue to counter terrorist threats in the region. The Mega Millions jackpot rolls over again. No one picked all six numbers. Tuesday's drawing, $322 million. Tonight's Powerball jackpot, $112 million. This is USA News.
The inventor and CEO of MyPillow is always looking for ways to solve everyday problems. Have you ever picked up a towel set because it felt really soft in the store, but then when you go to use it, it's not very absorbent? It's basically a towel that's leaving you out to dry. That's why MyPillow has developed the MyPillow towels. Towels that work. I know, it's mind-blowing. Towels that actually dry you. The six-piece towel set includes two bath towels, two hand towels, and two washcloths. They come in a variety of colors, and right now you can receive a six-piece set for only $39.98 with promo code USA. Go to MyPillow.com right now and click on the radio listener special. MyPillow products come with a 10-year warranty, and they have a 60-day money-back guarantee. To receive this amazing offer on the six-piece set of MyPillow towels, just go to MyPillow.com, click on the radio listener special, and enter promo code USA or call 800-951-8175. That's MyPillow.com, promo code USA.
Being this is a 44 Magnum, the most powerful handgun in the world, and would blow your head clean off, you've got to ask yourself one question. Do I feel lucky? Well, do you, punk?
Well, dear Blood River Radio family, we're going to go right back to my big sister, your big sister, the one and only Sister Nancy. Go ahead, Sister Nancy.
Okay. Attention, Blood River Radio listeners. This is the last of 5 weeks of Confederate history. Our classes are coming to an end, and in order for you to receive your Blood River Radio degree certificate, snail mail a one-page essay based on something that was discussed during our Confederate history classes. It must get to us by Saturday, April the 15th, That gives you 3 weeks from tonight. Professor Gene Andrews will grade your essay, and your degree will be mailed to you by the end of April 2023. So write this down. Write to Blood River Radio at Post Office Box 34636, Bartlett, Tennessee, 38184. I'm going to repeat this again later on in the program, but if this is an opportunity for you to receive an honorary degree from Blood River Radio in Confederate history. So keep on listening. I'm going to pitch out a couple of facts, and then Jean is going to add to this. But on both sides, Union and Confederate, the estimated death count was approximately 750,000 dead. About 400,000 of those would be Confederates, and they say that somewhere in the range of 50,000 Southern civilians were killed in the South, probably during Sherman's march through the South.
Damn.
So the total of all of the dead that were on both sides exceeds the total of all those Americans killed in every war after the Civil War. That would be the First World War, Second World War, Korean, Vietnam. Probably these things that they've been doing in the Middle East are also counted in that. That's what we think anyway. But I want to go back to Franklin just briefly. At the Battle of Franklin, which we have discussed in the past, in 5 hours, 1,750 Confederates were killed at the Battle of Franklin. 5,500 were wounded. Now, I did know that six Confederate generals died at the Battle of Franklin, but I did not know that seven additional Confederates were wounded and one was captured. That is a total of 14 Confederate generals succumbed to various injuries or death at the Battle of Franklin. One of the most interesting things that is kind of unusual, General John C. Carter was fighting at the Battle of Franklin right at the outside of his home. He was mortally wounded, and he was taken into his home inside in Franklin, and he died, I guess, a day or two later. So there's a couple other interesting facts I'll bring up later, but those are just a couple things that go back to Franklin, to the Battle of Franklin. So Gene probably has more to add to that. But
oh, no, that's really something. Yeah, that boy's name was a captain, Todd Carter, and the Carter House there in Franklin is a historic site now. And it used to be a place where they had Confederate historians or Southern historians that gave you a really good overview of the Battle of Franklin, what happened to this young boy. And he was a staff officer. He didn't have to go into the attack, and yet he did. He had been captured. He escaped prior to the Battle of Franklin, got back with his unit, and they were telling him, well, sir, you don't have to go. Well, this is just, you know, the enlisted men and the line officers that are going into this attack. And he said, no, I can see my house right up the Columbia Pike there. He said, I'm going in there. And, yeah, he got shot, and his sisters went out and found him on the battlefield that night. And he did die in his home, his own home, the next day. He suffered through the night and finally succumbed. And they used to have a Sons of Confederate Veterans camp in Franklin called the Todd Carter Camp. And they used to have people like Thomas Cartwright and David Fraley that were the curators and gave the tours there at the Carter House. But then Franklin and Williamson County has been taken over by the carpetbaggers that have moved in. And they got rid of the Southern people at the Carter House in Carnton, which is out there where the Confederate cemetery is, and they got them out. So now all they do is tell the Yankee stories that Confederates were launching that attack across 2 miles open ground, and all they were talking about was how they were going to enslave everybody. That's their story now.
I must have been confused, but I have a T-shirt that has John C. Carter, General John C. Carter.
Yeah, now that's right. John C. Carter was a general.
He was a general, but see, I was connecting him as one who died right there in the home there. But maybe
Mosco Carter was the owner of that, and the cotton gin across the road there. That was sort of the epicenter of the battle right there around there on their property. And the farm office outside the house there is just riddled with bullet holes, and they've never repaired that. And you go on a tour there, you see this building looks like it was hit with machine gun fire. But yeah, their boy was Todd Carter,
that was killed right there.
See, I'm confusing the issue because I know one of the generals did not die that day. He was mortally wounded, and I thought it was John C. Carter who died in the house there in Franklin. But you're saying it was Todd Carter, and I'm sure you're right about that. But I was thinking one of these generals did not die that day. But
that was John Carter, and he did. I think they got him out of there back down to Columbia and died down there. But yeah, Todd Carter was the one that was killed in his own yard, and like I said, his sisters went out and found him that night. And you know, every house in Franklin was turned into a hospital. It was a small town, probably only had about 800 residents at that time, and every house and the churches and the Masonic Hall, they were all hospitals for all the wounded there. And Carter House was used, and the McGavock home over there, Carnton Plantation, was used as a hospital, and their living room was an operating room. And they said they were pitching amputated arms and legs out the window, and by the next morning or next day, there was a huge pile of amputated limbs outside the window of that house. It was a brutal battle. It really was.
Of course, it was horrible.
And what happened there, and I think one reason that it was so horrible. The Confederates launched that attack about 4 o'clock that afternoon from Winstead Hill at the Federal Works. And, you know, 30th of November, it's dark by 5 o'clock. And that battle went on till 9:30 that night. So most of the fighting at Franklin was after dark. And after the initial breakthrough coming up the Columbia Pike, and the Confederates broke through right there on the grounds of the Carter House and penetrated the Federal lines and were turning the artillery around. Then the reinforcements came up and drove them back. They didn't go all the way back the 2 miles out to Winstead Hill where they started. They just fell back into the darkness. And then they would hear firing down there to the right, and they'd say, well, maybe those guys are breaking through down there, so here we go again. Bam, here comes another attack. And that one was stopped, and they fell back into the darkness, and then either got orders or heard firing somewhere else down the line, and here they go again. So, like I said, the initial hit against the Yankee lines was about 5 o'clock, maybe just a little bit before, and it went on until 9:30 that night. And finally, the Yankees got the bridge across the Harpeth River repaired or planked over. They planked over the railroad bridge, so the horses would walk across it, and they got their artillery and their supply wagons and everything out of there, and they were gone by 9:30 or 10 o'clock that night, and left all their dead and wounded on the battlefield. And
Well, I was just saying, compared to this was a 5-hour battle, and Pickett's charge was about 1 hour. But of course, there was a comparable number of people, soldiers were killed. But the Pickett's charge was really a 1 hour battle, basically. I think they went in one time and retreated, but they had that small
breakthrough at the angle there on Cemetery Ridge, but. Once they were driven back from there, then there was no more fighting on that. They went all the way back across that valley, back to the Confederate lines on Seminary Ridge, which was the Confederate position about a mile and a half away. So, it was a horrible episode there and totally unnecessary. We talked about the big snafu the night before at Spring Hill when they could have taken out the whole Army Corps, Schofield's Corps, the Yankee Army. And then at the conference that afternoon on the 30th, the next day, the 30th, at the Harrison House, Hood wouldn't listen to his officers like Forrest or Cheatham or Claiborne and advised him against it. And Forrest was the only officer that had been on that field before because he operated all the way through there in the year before that, 1863. And he knew all the roads around there and where the Harpeth River was and everything. And he was the one that suggested, you give me a division of infantry plus their artillery, and I'll take my cavalry. We'll swing around behind them up to the line of hills up north of Franklin and plug Hollow Tree Gap, and the Yankees would have been trapped, but they wouldn't listen to it.
Gene, we'll have to get right back to that as soon as we come back to this break. Plus, I have a question to ask the Bitter Ender.
former sheriff Richard Mack recounts in his book, The Proper Role of Law Enforcement, how he came to realize while working as a beat cop how wrong the all-too-common orientation of police officers is when they think of their job as being to write tickets and arrest people. Richard Mack tells of his personal transformation from by-the-number cop to constitution-conscious defender of citizen safety and freedoms. Learn what it really means to serve and protect. Purchase your copy at CSPOA.org. That's CSPOA.org.
Do you know what is great about America? Ask an immigrant. Ask an Immigrant is a new podcast dedicated to helping Americans, especially our youth, value, appreciate, and be grateful for the freedoms we have here in America. Join host Lydia Wallace Nuttall as she interviews immigrants from around the world to discover their inspiring personal stories about why they came to America. To learn more about why America is the most prosperous, greatest country in the world, download the Loving Liberty app or go to lovingliberty.net.
This is Michael Hill, Chief of the League of the South. I listen to Blood River Radio, and you should too. In fact, you should be telling your friends, your family, and your associates to listen to Eddie Miller and the good folks at Blood River Radio. They stand resolutely for the preservation of white civilization, what we once called Christendom, and they stand against the ongoing campaign of white genocide. In these trying and uncertain times, it's more important than ever to speak and act in defense of our God, our people, and our civilization. Blood River Radio speaks the truth and speaks it boldly. I've been on this show many times as a guest, and I'm very proud of my association with you. May our just cause prevail. Hail victory.
Dear Blood River Radio family, we're going to go right back to the Bitter Ender because he says he has some sobering information you need to pay attention to. Go ahead, Bitter Ender.
Well, we were talking during the break. You had a question about the date of the Battle of Franklin. That was the last day in November 30th, 1864. And the soldiers said it was sort of an Indian summer type of day. It was relatively warm for that type of year and kind of a golden haze as the sun was setting over to the west when this battle started. And like I said, they launched the attack at 4 o'clock. It takes about an hour to walk from Winstead Hill up to where the federal lines were just south of Franklin. Cause we had that, a march to the Carter House every year on the Sunday before the 30th. And, but nobody's shooting at us. We just walk up the road. It still takes an hour.
Thank God.
Yeah. And, That thing went on till 9:30 that night because it was one of the few battles that was fought in the darkness. And like I said, the Confederates didn't come all the way back to the 2 miles to Winstead Hill. They just fell back into the darkness, and they'd hear somebody firing off to the right. Bam, here they'd go again. Went on. The Yankees pulled out of there that night, got their artillery and their wagons across the Harpeth River, and they left all their dead and wounded. So the next morning, Hood is thinking there's going to be another day's battle fought. And the scouts went out, and they brought the word back, no, the Yankees are gone. So he forms the army up on the Columbia Pike. They come marching up the Columbia Pike right through Franklin and then up the Nashville-Franklin Turnpike headed to Nashville. But they're marching right across the battlefield. And they see their friends and remnants of what was left of that assault and piles of bodies, mangled bodies, piled up on that battlefield, and the stretcher bearers out there trying to find anybody that's still alive that can even be saved. And the soldiers were talking about, Sam Watkins in that Company H was talking about, any low place in the ground, a ditch alongside the road or just a little bit of a low area, was full of blood. And it was almost like it had rained blood the night before. There were so many dead and wounded, and they didn't die of old age. They'd been shot to pieces with rifle fire and canister that the federal artillery used on them at close range. And that's like having a giant shotgun firing all these balls out there, just ripping people to pieces. And these mangled bodies were all over the field. So that was a good morale booster for the Army of Tennessee to have Hood march his army right past all of that, then head on up the road. And you were asking about, was that pretty much the end of the Army of Tennessee? And yes, it was. because 2 weeks later, on the 15th and 16th of December, they fought the Battle of Nashville, which is another disaster. And his Hood's officers were telling him, you don't need to go all the way up to Nashville. He said, we need to fall back to the Duck River and get Thomas to bring his army out of Nashville to get us, because Lincoln and Halleck and Grant were burning up the telegraph lines for Thomas, General George Thomas in Nashville, to do something about this Confederate army in Tennessee. So we need to fall back to a line along the Duck River. He said, if we go up there close to Nashville, and even if we defeat Thomas, all he's got to do is retreat back 2 or 3 miles to the, all the forts that were built around Nashville after the Yankees captured Nashville in February of 1862. So they'd been fortifying. This was the first Confederate capital that fell to the Yankee armies. It was on a Cumberland River. It had about 4 railroad lines that came in there. That was a very, very important supply depot for the Yankee armies that were working out here in the Western Theater. So they really fortified it. And they said that Nashville was the most fortified city in North America next to Washington, D.C. So Hood, with a small army that had been pretty much destroyed at Franklin, thought he was going to lay siege to Nashville. And when then they got into a blizzard that hit, and the ground was frozen, and the Confederates were trying to dig holes in the ground and pull limbs over them to just cover themselves up during this freezing ice storm and that was hitting Nashville. And a lot of them were barefoot. They had not much to eat at all. A lot of them were eating sawdust mixed with cornmeal. Damn. And then when the Federals launched that attack on the 15th, it just swept them right off the field. And Hood decided to dig in on a second day on the 16th, about 4 or 5 miles south of the original line. And the same thing happened again. They were just, you know, they were outnumbered about 5-1. So the outcome was never in doubt. And then the other brilliant move he'd had, probably his best infantry commander, Patrick Claiborne, had been killed at Franklin. His best officer in the Army, Bedford Forrest, he sent him away to Murfreesboro to try to capture a supply depot at Murfreesboro. So Forrest's cavalry wasn't even on the field during the Battle of Nashville. He had one division under Chalmers, James Chalmers, that was left there, but that they couldn't do anything. You know, it was like 60,000 against 20-something thousand. So that outcome of that was never in doubt. But I think, Nancy, you had a letter that was talking about Franklin. To give our listeners that or any other
thing.
Well,
I'm afraid I'd like maybe start the next quarter, because it's going to take a few minutes to read it. I was going to point out something
minutes.
An excuse for Hood was that he was, you know, we had talked about this before, his terrible amputation, and he was obviously suffering a great deal pain in a lot of pain. He was taking laudanum. For people who don't know, that is opium. And we were discussing how medicines were very difficult to obtain, almost impossible. The Federals had stopped any kind of medicine from getting to the South. The women were trying to secrete them under their skirts and bring them secretly into the South. So the people were really suffering. So that was the only relief that he had, would be to take laudanum. I will read one little. I've got several quotes by Patrick Claiborne, who died at, who was killed. He was one of the 6 generals who was killed at Franklin. This is just a brief statement that he said. It is said slavery is all we are fighting for, and if we give it up, we give up all. Even if this were true, which we deny. Slavery is not all our enemies are fighting for. It is merely the pretense to establish sectional superiority and a more centralized form of government, and to deprive us of our rights and liberties. And that is exactly what the war was all about. We can go back to the reasons. They go back into the 1830s. There were lots of problems in Congress between the Northerners and the Southerners 30 years before the war ever began. And as you know, we didn't actually cover this. We haven't covered this before, but there were several things that came up in 1861, the increase in the import tariff into the South. The morale tariff was a bad thing that the Southerners were opposed to. This was actually a a financial imposition on Southerners. And then you also had the Corwin Amendment of 1861, in which Lincoln would have agreed that slavery would stay permanently in the entire nation, wouldn't be changed if the Southerners would not go to war. But that proved that was not the issue that the Southerners were fighting for. They wanted their freedom. They wanted their liberty. That was not an issue. It could have been a collateral issue, but basically it was. I go back to the fact of these states that came in free and some that were coming in slave. This was going to be a battle for control of the Congress. This is actually what it really was all about, in my opinion. And of course, the South knew that they were going to lose that battle. So there were many issues. It certainly was not all about slavery. That's just another red herring.
Oh, exactly. Yeah, another false flag issue that the United States government uses for every war. Every war has been a lie.
Of course.
We fought in, whether it was World War One or Frankie Roosevelt in World War Two and Preppy Boy Bush and all the others. It's still a lie. So, you know, that's what they do. That's the nature of the Yankee beast that we live under. And it's so frustrating to have people keep throwing that slavery nonsense in our face. So you're right, that Corwin Amendment passed the United States Congress when the Southern states left. And there were four states, you know, you have to have a certain number of states, percentage of states ratify an amendment to the Constitution. There were four states in the North that ratified it. And Lincoln said he would sign it if the seven southern states that had left would come back in, and you had those seven states, that would have passed, and slavery would have been a constitutional amendment. And then that would take another constitutional amendment, just like Prohibition, to override that and get it out, which probably never would have happened. I don't know how long slavery would have existed if that Corwin Amendment had been passed. And the other thing that I always ask these people that tell us, oh, well, it was about slavery, I ask them, how do you explain the Hampton Roads Conference? And they go, I never heard of that. And I said, no, of course you won't hear about it. They don't teach that at school. But at Hampton Roads, Virginia, Vice President Alexander Stevens of the Confederate States met with Abraham Lincoln on the presidential yacht and said, all right, now if you've changed the course of the war from reuniting the country and preserving the Union to abolishing slavery, what if we abolished slavery? Would you give us our independence? And Lincoln turned him down because he figured another year or so of war, what's another 10,000 lives? He didn't care. You know, little did he know one of those lives is going to be his. But, so the Corwin Amendment and the and Southerners, even before the war ever started, they said, well, if the abolitionists want slavery ended, why don't you do what the British did and pay the colonists for their investment in slaves? Yeah, why don't you do what the French did? Pay them, the colonists, for the investment. Pay them for the...
Wouldn't that have been the best way to go? Wouldn't that have been the answer? That would have been the answer.
It would have saved 700,000 lives and several $1 billion in war debt that was run up there. So, but they didn't want that. They wanted the South destroyed. They wanted to take it over and make the South an agricultural colony of the North, which is what they did. And it took literally 100 years for the South to get out from under that burden. And there are states today that still haven't recovered from that.
Absolutely.
Their economy was so destroyed and stolen. And what the war didn't destroy, then the carpetbaggers and the imposed government that was put on us during Reconstruction, they stole what the war didn't destroy. So,
I've got an unusual fact that maybe listeners who are studying their Confederate history, maybe they know about this, and I'm sure you do, Gene. Wilmer McLean, he is connected with the beginning and the end of the war, and I'm sure you know why.
Yeah.
Because the Battle of First Manassas was fought around his farm. And in order to avoid these engagements, he moved down to Appomattox, where the surrender was signed in his house.
Yes.
In the McLean house. So I think that's rather interesting.
Well, it is. And they said the war started in his kitchen. a cannonball came through the wall and hit the chimney in the kitchen. It started in his kitchen and ended in his front parlor. And that's where Lee and Grant met to sign the surrender documents in the front, in the living room or front parlor of McLean's house in Appomattox Courthouse, Virginia. So started and ended right there in his house.
Folks, hear the music, so we're going to transition to the third hour. We'll pick up with the Bitter Ender and Sister Nancy as soon as we come back from this break, starting the third hour. Be right back, folks.